Mr. Lerner.
Good morning. The federal courthouse is a public courthouse. There's a presumption of public access to documents filed in the federal courthouse in order to promote values of openness, public confidence in the judiciary, credibility, legitimacy, and to serve the public interest.
So, Mr. Lerner, I'll say right away that I'm entirely in favor of all of those values that you just articulated. But here, we have a somewhat bizarre set of circumstances. We have, for one thing, the district court saying because its hands are tied by EMECF, it can't get rid of these documents. You know, once filed, always filed. Secondly, the district court does say, I agree briefly, but the district court says, I don't know why these documents are relevant. Plaintiffs, I know not you, but plaintiffs, if you can tell me why they're relevant, even though they're not cited in your moving papers, fine. You know, if they're relevant, then we'll let the other side go through the process of saying, no, it should be sealed because it's a trade secret, or it should be sealed because it's attorney-client, or whatever other reasons they may have for sealing. But, and then, of course, the third bizarre situation is that this is, it's a well-used but somewhat unusual use of Rule 24B intervention. It's not that you really have a common question with the underlying case. You're here to vindicate the rights of people to an open court system.
That's
well
correct.
And good. That's fine. At least it's fine with me. But the case is now over. But where I really stick is on the district judge's comment, you have to tell me why this is relevant, why this all these extra things not cited are relevant before I'm going to shift the burden to Syngenta to explain why perhaps some of them should be withheld. So maybe you could start there.
This came up, Your Honor, in a context where Syngenta filed a motion to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction.
Right, and I'm very familiar with such motions.
The plaintiffs then came back and sought to establish contacts with
right.
the state.
Right, and so you need a lot of discovery. The Insurance Corporation
right.
of Ireland case talks about that with foreign companies. We're familiar.
That's correct, Your Honor. So what happened then was in the brief in opposition, and the court eventually ruled in favor of the plaintiffs on this, the plaintiffs cited a large number of documents that they attached as an exhibit with a summary of the documents. I believe they cited about 120 documents in the brief. There was an additional set of documents that were used to establish jurisdiction and contacts that were contained in an exhibit with a chart that summarized the value of each of the documents, and those were referenced specifically in their brief. What the court did was something of a bootstrap here. The district court said, if a document is directly cited in the brief, then it's open for disclosure, subject to Syngenta demonstrating trade secrets, attorney-client privilege, or one of the other small exemptions to public access. What the court then said was, if the party did not directly cite it in the brief, but just cited the exhibit with the attachments, the court didn't get there. The court apparently found sufficient contacts in what was directly cited that on the merits it didn't need to get to the rest of the contacts that were in the appendix.
But it announces ex ante that it's not going to look at these.
Right. The court.
I don't think you should take it as established that anything cited in the brief is effectively in the public record unless it's a trade secret.
No, the
right?
court
imagine.
So far, okay.
Well, the district court may have said that, but I don't think you should assume that that's the rule, right? Imagine somebody who brings a lawsuit for the principal purpose of getting some stuff into the public record and then just files a brief saying, I don't see any way we can win in this case, but I hereby cite, and then cites every document.
In that circumstance,
that's real bootstrapping.
Okay. In that circumstance, Your Honor, there's Rule 11. And indeed, there is a exemption for, if you will, improper.
Well, it doesn't have anything to do with whether documents remain in the public record. You're now suggesting that the document is in the public record, that whatever legitimate claim of secrecy there was that is not technically a trade secret is now gone, and that the plaintiff's lawyer should have his wrist slapped. That doesn't seem right either.
Your Honor, what I'm suggesting is there's case law that says if there's an improper purpose or a Rule 11 sanction, the judge can then rely upon that to exclude public access. That's not the case here, and indeed in terms of my client's position, reply brief page 1, the judge made very clear our hands were clean.
I must say, if you think it's hard to deal with these things now, trying to evaluate whether somebody had an improper purpose is just a swamp.
Your Honor, I understand that, and actually the FTC versus AbbVie case in the 11th Circuit discusses that in some length and comes out on the side of we have a strong public interest in public access to the judiciary, and that has to outweigh the difficulty.
You've seen the opinions from this circuit.
I have.
And these opinions, like Baxter, regularly say the public interest concerns documents that informed or were the basis of a judicial decision. Right? That doesn't reach documents that were dropped into the record but had nothing to do with any judicial decision.
Your Honor, the bond decision.
That's why I stress, let me just add to that. It's one thing if there is a list of documents, 1 through 100, that are before the court, and then in the final opinion the court says, well, actually, at the end of the day, I only thought 1 through 50 were relevant, so I disregarded the others. You might say there's a public interest in seeing the ones that the judge disregarded. Mm-hmm. We have a different case. Our case is the judge saying, before I even take this under advisement, I am just going to exclude this 243 document bunch or, you know, whatever the number was that are not cited because other than in this little summary, because I don't see what their relevance is. And the judge says, I'll unseal and consider any exhibit if the plaintiffs can explain its relevance to me. He opens the door. And so we know he doesn't consider them because he says, but for this weird EMECF thing, he would have actually unfiled them.
First of all, Your Honor, in the bond case, this circuit talked about documents that could have influenced as well as ones that actually did.
Oh, absolutely. That's the point of my first hypothetical. But I think if the judge says, you know, the things that aren't filed are just, as far as I'm concerned, not before me.
The Second Circuit addressed this in the Lubosch case, where the Second Circuit says it's as important to see from the public standpoint what the judge did not rely upon as well as what the judge did rely upon.
But
sure.
You could file every single item of discovery on that theory and then put the incredible expense and burden on the other side, however this goes, plaintiff or defendant. It doesn't make any difference.
We obviously weren't involved in the litigation strategy of the plaintiffs or the defendants. But the situation that we have in this case is that the documents were filed. It was, Your Honor, a dispositive motion, which goes to the Chief Judge's question earlier, not a side motion. This was a dispositive motion to dismiss. And on that, plaintiffs made what, at least looking from the outside, is an intelligent decision to make sure that they demonstrated as many contacts as they could. There's a difference between what the judge did in terms of saying, for purposes of ruling on the merits of the motion, once I read the directly cited documents in the brief, I was persuaded, and on the merits, I'm ready to move forward. There's a difference between that and the question of what should the public have access to. The public should have access to documents that are filed in the public courthouses. We've looked at this, again, in a different context, in a motion for summary judgment, again, a motion to dismiss. A judge might find that once he or she was satisfied that there was one or two facts in dispute, not a need to get to the other 10 facts in dispute, because you can rule against the motion to dismiss based on the first two. But once the documents are there, they're in the public record.
Well, that's what we're here to decide. I mean,
yes, you are.
He says, because these documents were not cited in the party's briefs, either side, the court will not consult them in making its rulings. Now, we know under Rule 56, if a judge wants to look at more evidence, materials not cited, 56C3, the court is entitled to. The court need consider only the cited materials, but it may consider other materials in the record.
That's correct.
That's the rule. So coming at it from that point of view as well, when the judge says, in effect, I'm exercising my discretion under Rule 56 to consider only those documents that are cited, the judge isn't looking at one of the uncited documents and saying, I'm not persuaded by it. The judge is telling you what's in the record before the
court. Two different types of discretion. The question of discretion when it goes to resolving the merits. In theory, the judge could have found one contact and said, that's good enough. I don't need to look at anything else.
But the judge must consider the cited materials. That's the other part of the rule that I
That's correct. Said. And there were a number of documents cited in the brief. But the judge's discretion goes to, on the merits, what does the judge review, what does the judge look at. And in this case, the judge said, I was satisfied based on what I looked at in the brief that was directly cited that on the merits the motion to dismiss should be denied. That's different than under the law, common law, First Amendment principles, this court's decisions in Bond, Baxter, Grow Fresh, and so forth, about where the judge's discretion is or isn't when it comes to public access to documents that have been filed. A judge may or may not rely upon all sorts of material in a record in reaching his or her decision. That's within the judge's discretion. But that's a different question than what's in the record and what should be available for public access. And that gets into the decisions by this circuit and the First, the Second, the 11th Circuit, the decisions in FTC versus AbbVie in the 11th, Kravitz in the First, Lugash in the Second, in which the circuits have also found, along with the Seventh Circuit, the important right of public access to documents that are in the judicial record and filed in the public courthouse.
Mr. Lerner, can
yes,
I ask
sir.
You a question about the protective order in this case? Maybe I'm missing something, but it says this protective order does not govern the use of confidential information at trial or in connection with dispositive motions. Was it necessary for these documents to be filed under seal?
Your Honor, I had exactly that same question before the district court. We don't believe that it was, in light of the protective order, necessary for them to be filed under seal. For whatever reason, the plaintiffs did so. Again, we're coming in as an intervener.
Does that affect the calculus here?
It affects the calculus in that the defendants did not have an expectation that those documents would be private and kept out of the public record when it comes to public access for a dispositive motion, and the motion to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction is a dispositive motion. The defendants did not make their case with regard to trade secrets or the other exemptions. I want to save, if I could, a couple minutes for rebuttal, but I also do want to answer your question.
I'd like to just throw out one other question. All of us are concerned about, I suspect, the prospect that, of just flooding a record with lots of irrelevant
Correct.
Documents. And I guess with that, and I've certainly seen that in the district court from time to time, I'm wondering if why the use of citation as a proxy, in essence, for relevance is not adequate for these purposes.
Because parties
as a threshold. Because
as a practical matter, a party that wanted to engage in the activity you're describing could just cite everything under the hymn book.
And that would be pretty transparent.
But here there were documents cited directly, and there were documents that were part of an exhibit that was referenced in the brief and attached. The plaintiff's attorney made a decision what it wanted to cite directly and what it wanted to rely upon the exhibit. We're not here to second-guess that one way or the other. The fact of the matter is the protective order, as you've pointed out, did not cover documents to be sealed under a dispositive motion. These documents were in the public record. The public has a right of public access that should not turn upon whether a party decides to cite or not cite a document and whether a judge relies heavily.
Yeah, perhaps 20 seconds left.
Okay. Your Honor, let me just ask them that the court reverse and remand, unseal the documents, and I'll save 10 seconds for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lerner. Mr. Murphy.
Good morning, Your Honors. Chris Murphy on behalf of the defendants, appellees, Syngenta Crop Protection and Syngenta AG. The district court here should be affirmed. The court simply did not abuse its discretion in deciding on the unique facts of this case to maintain certain documents under seal.
But I want to go immediately to the facts of this case, because this is, as I understand it, not a situation where the plaintiffs threw the kitchen sink in with their filing in this personal jurisdiction matter. They cite a lot of documents, and then perhaps thinking they're saving the district court some time, they summarize the rest of the documents in exhibits. So they've gleaned them out of the mass of discovery already. So that's the first reason why this isn't maybe a one-size-fits-all. And the second thought that I have is that I'm very reluctant to close the public record as a remedy to a problem that really seems to be a financial burden problem. The court has a lot of tools at its disposal if somebody has multiplied proceedings so as to impose costs on others. There's statutes about that. There's Rule 11. That Rule 26C allows for remedies. It refers over to Rule 37. Costs can be shifted if somebody has imposed a lot of needless financial burden on others. And it seems to me that's much more tailored to the problem that we have than just sealing.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, on the first issue, there was an index of documents, but that's all it was. It was an index. That doesn't say anything about the substance of any of the other.
Well, it depends what the index says, really. I mean, if we're trying to prove that Syngenta had enough contact, that the particularly the Swiss entity had enough contacts with the United States to satisfy our personal jurisdiction standards. I'm sure there was a difference of opinion because Switzerland has a different view on that, but but there could be documents about sales. It depends what the name of it is.
If the plaintiffs had wanted to bring this to the court's attention, as Your Honor previously said, there was a motion to strike here filed by Syngenta as to these 242 documents. Instead of taking the time to explain to the court how each of these documents relates to the various arguments in their lengthy briefing, they simply said everything should be unsealed because that was the position they wanted to take. They attached everything, including the brief itself, put it all in one big filing, and filed it all under seal. The court tried to fix some of those problems. It took the brief out, and then it allowed Syngenta to address the remaining documents and say which ones should be unsealed and which ones should remain under seal, and Syngenta then gave the facts as to why that should stay confidential. But as to your second question, Your Honor, what you asked about is, isn't this really a cost issue? Well, no, it's not. The question is, no presumption even arises unless there's some First Amendment or common law interest at issue.
I'm not sure. Rule 5D talks about documents, quote, used in the judicial proceeding. And I think we have a question before we get to the First Amendment or anything more grand, which is whether the documents summarized in this exhibit fall within the category of documents used or not. Because if they do fall within that category, then they're properly filed as discovery materials and our usual rules about public access to courts kick in.
Well, Your Honor, that's the issue that has to be within the discretion of the trial court. That is the trial court's obligation to manage its docket.
What about monitoring the trial court's exercise of that discretion? I mean, you don't want a trial court to say, well, I decided not to use a copy of the original contract because, you know, it seemed to me beside the point, where everybody else might think it was really very much to the point, and the Court of Appeals might reverse for refusing to consider a document.
And in that case, that might be, in fact, an abuse of discretion, and that's what we're dealing with here. We have a unique set of facts where the court would have stricken these documents from the record. It did not intend to use any of those documents in any way, shape, or form in this case. We know that ex ante, as Judge Hamilton said. We also know it after the fact, because he said exactly that he found jurisdictional contacts only on the documents he had.
Presumably you all disagreed with that decision, right?
Just disagreed with?
The decision on personal jurisdiction, right?
Of course you did.
So let's suppose no settlement had been reached in the underlying litigation. Litigation goes forward. There's an appeal. plaintiffs, I assume, would then be perfectly free to rely on every document that was summarized in the summary exhibit, right, to defend the district judge's decision.
If the decision had not stricken them from the record?
I don't think it did strike them. But whether it struck them or not, that decision itself could be challenged, and the plaintiffs could say, wait a minute, you've struck our best ammunition. You know, you might have found jurisdiction on a rather thin basis of other documents, but in fact we've got tons of documents to show jurisdiction. We need those to convince the Court of Appeals or ultimately the Supreme Court that we've got jurisdiction. Those all sound like documents being used in the proceeding.
And in fact, you might find that it was an abuse of discretion if the facts had been, in fact, reversed. If we had won below and the court had said there's no jurisdiction at all, then the interveners and or, well, the plaintiffs in this case,
does
would
the
actually
fact that you gave up with a settlement, though, remove the public's interest in this alternative?
Well, the settlement doesn't affect anything. It's the question of what did the judge do? What was the decision-making process? What he did was say, I'm not going to use any of those documents in ruling on the motion to dismiss. So the hypothetical you raised just never came up. It's not
but
the facts of this case.
Precisely what Judge Hamilton is saying is, had the case gone forward, someone would have been entitled to say that the judge's decision to exclude the summarized documents, and here we're being very careful not to talk about whatever else was floating around out there that didn't even make the summary. But you could say that was an abuse of discretion. We actually had a lot of evidence on personal jurisdiction, and just because somebody might think this is too thin a basis, there's really lots more. So, I mean, yes, it's settled. That truncates our ability to know what happened, so we have to deal in hypotheticals.
I agree with Your Honors. I mean, that's a different set of facts that might lead to not being an abuse of discretion under that situation. If he had said, I'm not going to consider these documents, and then I'm going to rule against the plaintiffs, that may have been an abuse of discretion, just like Your Honor's hypothetical earlier about a judge. It's a different scenario when a judge looks at documents and says, well, I don't think these over here are really relevant, so I'm not going to consider them, but I'll look at these other documents. That's not our facts. I mean, it is a unique scenario here where the judge said, the plaintiffs should come forward and give me some basis as to whether I should consider even these documents. And the plaintiffs didn't do that. And so the judge
was that before or after the denial of the motion to dismiss?
Long before.
Okay.
What happened was the judge, as soon as this was filed under seal, this big block of documents, the court entered a rule to show cause immediately and said, why should these not all be unsealed? And in response to that order to show cause, Syngenta filed its motion to strike. It said, well, judge, there's an easy way to fix this. Rather than having you go through 365 documents, 242 of these have no relevance to the case, were not cited, and should never have been filed in the first place. And then here the rest we'll deal with, and the court did.
Mr. Murphy, let me ask you the question I raised earlier. Were the plaintiffs required to file these documents under seal, given paragraph, I think it's 18 of the protective order?
It's not clear that they were, and regardless, but I agree with your second question you asked before. It's irrelevant to the outcome here because the court then said these documents are not going to be considered by this court anyway because they have no bearing
on the
issues.
That's a different question than whether they should still be sealed. There are all sorts of things courts don't consider that are unsealed and probably nobody ever looks at them, but they're not.
If they should never have been sealed in the first place.
Well, that was an issue that was not raised by any of the parties. It was disputed because the court just simply raised the issue, should they be unsealed, and we got into this position of the motion to strike.
I'm asking whether that isn't just a much simpler solution to this whole problem in this case, to say these things aren't protected by the protective order. There's no issue here. Unseal them.
Well, Your Honor, but then the problem the district court was facing, though, was all these documents were just attached in bulk. They should never have been there in the first place. They shouldn't have been filed in the court file. And that's what the judge was using his discretion to do, is to say, whether confidential or not confidential, these documents shouldn't be before me at all. And that's the discretionary act that's really at issue here, and that we believe is not an abuse of discretion, when another party just dumps documents on a judge. The judge should be able to say, well, wait a second, why are all these documents in front of me? And then rule, okay, I don't want to look at all these or hear anything about all these documents.
But there's nothing in Rule 5 that speaks of judicial oversight of the documents that are used in the proceeding. Rule 5 makes sure that the bulk of discovery, unless or until it's used, isn't considered part of the record. But I don't see where you're getting some rule that the judge has to sit there and evaluate whether people should have used a document or not.
Well, I agree, Your Honor, but, you know,
and
I'll
frankly,
give you...
frankly, 365, I know you're trying to make that sound like a big number, but it doesn't really strike me as a crazy number.
Well, Your Honor, let me point you to your case in the County Materials Corporation versus Block case, a 2007 decision of this court that Your Honor authored. In that case, we think that calls for exactly the resolution of the case here. In that case, the plaintiffs filed the exact same, made the same argument here, that everything that was filed should have been unsealed. But Your Honor said that there was no abuse of discretion because the district court had at least unsealed the documents it relied on. And that was what was at issue in the case, and therefore there was no abuse of discretion. Our case, I think, is even more unique facts where the court ex ante said, I will not consider these documents. So I think following, you know, that decision, there's a very good justification for what the court did here. And again, bringing...
do you think it would be within a district court's power to appoint a special master for the purpose of vetting documents to determine whether they were properly sealed and then taxing the parties with the cost of the master?
I think that's not only allowable, I think that's what's done in certain occasions where the district court judge wants to appoint a special master to do that. I won't spend any time going through the bond decision at length. I think that case is distinguishable primarily because I don't think there's any case that stands for the simple proposition that the interveners are suggesting here, that every document, as soon as it's filed, is automatically part of the presumption of public access. And again,
of course, this court, when there's been sealing at the district court level and a notice of appeal is filed, requires re-justification of keeping documents under seal. So we, in fact, follow the presumption that you're talking about.
Well, in fact, that's an excellent point, but this court also, under its standard operating procedure 10, allows, and that's what the Baxter case and the Foster cases say, sometimes the better result is for the parties to take documents out of the record and send them back to the district court to maintain under seal because they have no bearing on the issues on appeal.
You put in a clause that's not part of our operating procedure. We allow documents to be sent back to the district court. It doesn't mean they will be under seal. Whether they're under seal is still a potentially contestable issue in the district court. What the operating procedure means is that we won't decide it in the Court of Appeals because it's completely unnecessary. But it doesn't mean that they are necessarily going to stay sealed forever.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. But the flip side of that, it also doesn't mean that every single document is per se unsealed, and it also doesn't mean that the party that sealed the documents must establish to the appellate court the confidentiality of every single solitary document just because it's in the record and came up to this court.
If they want it in the appellate record, they have to. If they don't need it in the appellate record, then it's the district court's problem.
And we just
analogize. Our view is if either side wants it in the appellate record, then secrecy has to be justified.
And we analogize to that rule in the same discretion this court has to grant those motions to send the documents back down to the district court. This is essentially what Judge Gilbert did here in saying, these documents aren't really properly before me in the first place, so I don't have to get to the next issue of the confidentiality of these documents.
I have a question for both sides. Maybe we need some supplemental briefing on this. But I was struck by the fact that neither side's brief discusses the bearing of Seattle Times against Reinhart on this case. And I, for one, am interested in what you might have to say about it.
Well, I think Seattle Times...
I didn't invite you to continue to talk, however. Your time has expired. We will accept supplemental filings from the parties within 14 days.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have...
Your Honors, I'll be very brief.
20 seconds. You will be very brief.
Judge Hamilton, yes, the documents shouldn't have been sealed in the first place, and that's why we moved to intervene. Chief Judge, on your question about special master, all the documents were assigned to a magistrate, those which were open for public access. The magistrate ruled that every one of those documents should be open and rejected Syngenta's claims. Finally, on the county materials case, in that, Judge Wood, you said the party hadn't showed why they were prejudiced or pointed to specific documents. We did. And the prejudice here is this involves atrazine, which contaminates the public water supply.
Thank you, counsel.
This is a case for public access. Thank you very much.
Case is taken under advisement.